This conference is being recorded.
Lula, you can press star 6 to get unmuted.
Okay, great. Can everyone hear me okay? Tony, you're hearing me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, good. Okay, well, thanks everybody so much for joining us. We are really pleased to welcome our webinar series that the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy started several months ago to bring our members and supporters cutting-edge information about the work that we're doing around the region and on critical topics such as what we're going to cover today. Today's lunchtime webinar is entitled Southeast in a Warmer World, the State of Knowledge from the U.S. Global Change Research Program. And I'd like to introduce you to Tony Reale. Before I do this real quick, I'd like to remind you that at the end of this webinar, we will have a question and answer session. Everyone is currently on mute, and then when we open it up for question and answer, you'll be able to unmute yourselves by hitting star 6. There's also a chat feature where you can chat questions in, and I believe raise your hand virtually. So I'd like to introduce you to Tony Reale. Tony is Southern Alliance for Clean Energy's Southeast Coastal Climate Organizer. And Tony joined SACE in June of 2008. She works out of Charleston, South Carolina. And Tony is very well suited to present to you today because prior to joining the SACE staff, she was an adjunct faculty member of the Department of Geology and Environmental Geosciences at the College of Charleston. And Tony also earned her Master's of Science degree in Geosciences from the University of Massachusetts Amherst in 2006. She studied climate change there, and her thesis focused on paleoclimatology. So she has a particular interest in the science, and I think we'll offer a lot of great information today about this new report that's recently come out. With SACE, Tony's primary responsibility is working to manage a network of environmental groups and citizen activists from Maryland to Louisiana. This group is called the Southeast Coastal Climate Network, and she'll tell you a little bit more about this at the end. But the group works collectively to create a unified voice of advocates calling for the protection of the Southeast's uniquely vulnerable coastal resources, which we'll talk about in this presentation. So let me just tell you real quick on the next slide about Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. I think many folks are already familiar with our organization, but just briefly, here's a little bit of background. We have over 20 years of advocacy history on clean energy, clean air, and working on utility issues. We have five main program areas that we cover, including clean energy, clean fuels, a high-risk energy program in which we work on coal and nuclear facilities, global warming advocacy, and energy efficiency. We cover 8 states across the region. We have 5 main offices with numerous satellite offices. And we work at various levels of decision making, state, federal, utility service commissions, utilities directly, and also directly with the public, doing some grassroots advocacy and education. And let me just point out before we move into the presentation here, earlier this year we revamped our website and really encourage folks to visit it often. You will be able, as I mentioned earlier, to get this webinar after the fact on our webinar section of our new website, and you can also access many of the other webinars from this series and some other series that we have there. So that's a great feature that we have. And we have a new blog called Clean Energy Footprints. Would encourage everybody to bookmark that and stay up to date with the issues that we're working on a daily basis. So thank you for taking time out of your day today to hear this presentation. And without further ado, I'll turn it over to Tony.
Great. Thanks, Ula, for that introduction. And I appreciate everyone's time today and joining us here as part of this webinar series. I am going to advance to the next slide. I do want to just make a note that sometimes there is a little delay between me changing the slide on my computer and you seeing this. I do apologize for that. So as Ula mentioned, I will be briefing you today on a recent report titled Global Climate Change Impacts in the United States. This report, and you can see the cover there on the left, was commissioned by the U.S. government and summarizes the science and impacts of climate change in the United States now and into the future. The report is largely based on results from the U.S. Global Change Research Program, and you can see there on the bottom some of the organizations that are part of this research program. And this report integrates a larger body of scientific information and research from around the world, including results from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change from 2007, that IPCC report. While this report focuses on impacts to various societal and environmental sectors across the region, it does highlight some mitigation adaptation options that I will include here in as we go through the presentation. And I will only be focusing on their discussions and their results for the Southeast, but for those of you who are interested in these impacts throughout the country, there's a link there on the bottom of the slide to the full reports, as well as fact sheets and images that will be very useful for communicating this message and this science to others. What I think is one of the most valuable attributes to this report is that it is written in plain language, which allows public and private decision makers to incorporate this into their decision making at all levels of government. So before I go on to the next slide, I do want to say that understanding the global climate system as well as past global climatic changes is essential to understanding what changes are occurring now and what predictions there are for the future. So in brief here, I will provide a global context for the observed and predicted climate changes that I'll explain in this PowerPoint. As I advance to the next slide, I'd like for you to follow the red line with your eyes. And again, I apologize for any delay there. Not that line. I'm somehow missing a slide. Sorry about that. Apologies for this interruption. I don't know what happens. Okay. Somehow when I put this into the PC, the slide got reversed. Okay. So let's follow this red line with your eyes. What you're looking at here is a climate record derived from the analysis of air bubbles trapped in an Antarctic ice core. The record that you're looking at, if you look at the x-axis there, extends back 800,000 years and documents the Earth's changing carbon dioxide concentrations. That's essentially what that red line is. And over this long geologic period, natural factors have caused the atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration to vary between 170 and 300 parts per million, or PPMs. And as a result of human activities, the present carbon dioxide concentration is about 390 parts per million today, which is 30% above its highest level over the last 800,000 years. I would like to mention that although this is looking at one Antarctic ice core, we see the same trend in hundreds and thousands of paleo records throughout the globe. So in the absence of strong control measures, emissions projected for this century would result in CO2 concentrations increasing to a level that is roughly 2 to 3 times higher than any level occurring over this time span. One key finding of this report, actually the number one key finding of this report, is that global warming is unequivocal and primarily human-induced. This bolsters the same conclusions from the IPCC report from 2007. So let's take a look at this graph here. The blue band that you see in the image shows climate model results about how global average temperatures would have changed due to natural forces only. These would be things like orbital parameters, sunspot cycles, et cetera. The red band shows model projections of the effects of human and natural forces combined. The black line shows actual observed and documented global average temperatures. Now, looking back at that blue line, the blue band indicates that without anthropogenic forces, that's human forces, temperatures over the past 100 years would have actually warmed, then cooled over recent decades. The emissions responsible for human-induced warming primarily come from the burning of fossil fuels, including coal, oil, and natural gas, with additional contributions from our agricultural practices, such as clearing forests and other agricultural activities. So what we see here is that increases in temperature at the lower end of this range are more likely if global heat-trapping emissions are cut substantially. If emissions continue to rise at or near current rates, temperature increases are more likely to be near the upper end of the range. And we'll talk about temperature impacts and how they relate to the Southeast here in a second. So what we see is that the second key finding of this report is that climate changes are already underway and are projected to grow. And so we'll start with temperature changes and what is in store for the Southeast and what our options are. So let's look at this graph. The image on the left depicts the number of days per year with peak temperatures over 90 degrees Fahrenheit. So the image on the left is from 1961 to 1979, and the one on the right is was made using predictive climate models for 2080 to 2099, so the later part of this century. And what this report states is that since 1970, the average annual temperatures have already risen about 2 degrees Fahrenheit, with the greatest seasonal increase occurring during the winter months. And we expect that these temperatures will rise significantly, especially under those higher emission scenarios, as if we don't cut global warming pollution. By 2080, we could see temperature increases on the order of 4.5 to 9 degrees Fahrenheit. This report states that the Southeast might actually experience up to 10.5 degrees Fahrenheit in the summer months. That is significant. And not only will these temperatures rise, but the rate of warming will increase to more than double since 1975. And we all know that any increase in hot days will have consequences for human health, agriculture, drought, wildfires, etc. So let's look here at how precipitation patterns will shift. In the graph, you see spring, summer, fall, and winter images for the Southeast, and the bluer the color, the increase in precipitation, the browner the color, the decrease. So while average fall precipitation in the Southeast increased by 30% since the early part of the century, summer and winter precipitation declined by nearly 10%. What's interesting to note here is that southern Florida has experienced a nearly 10% drop in precipitation in spring, summer, and fall, and that as over the entire region, we're expecting an increase in drought conditions over the next few decades. I would like to point out here something that this report briefly explains, and that is that climate models are providing divergent predictions for precipitation in the Southeast, and that's really due to the difficulty in modeling rain patterns. There is a really great report called When It Rains, It Pours. There's a link to that report. We also did a webinar with one of the authors, Travis Madsen, and that's available on our website as well. Water resources are at risk, and rising temperatures, longer periods of time between rainfall events, and an increase in demand will decrease in water availability. Additionally, the amount and timing of water availability to natural systems will also be affected, and particularly how we as humans respond to this shortage. During droughts, recharge of groundwater will decline as temperatures and spacing between rainfall events occur. And if we respond, which we are right now, by increasing groundwater pumping, this will only lead to further stress or depleted aquifers, placing increasing strain on surface water resources. And we already see this happening in the Southeast, something called saltwater intrusion. And saltwater intrusion into shallow aquifers is likely in many parts of the Southeast. This report highlights what some cities in the U.S. are, how they're dealing with their vulnerable freshwater resources. For example, in Olympia, Washington, there's been concern about sea level rise. And what the city has done is it has incorporated the predictive models into their decision-making process. They've actually relocated their primary drinking water resources from a low-lying surface water source to wells on higher ground. Also, in Kings County, Washington, they've already begun incorporating porous concrete and rain gardens into their road projects to manage the effects of stormwater runoff, which can lead to pollution of freshwater resources. I would like to point out here that this report has multiple examples of adaptation strategies for impacts, and I'll be discussing them, but it's interesting to note that next to none of them highlight measures that have been taken in the Southeast. So out of this whole 200-page report and about, 10 examples of model adaptation strategies, none of them come from the South. And we have some work to do. So let's talk about rising seas. Recent global sea level rise has been caused, of course, by the warming-induced expansion of oceans. That's thermal expansion, accelerated melting of glaciers, and loss of ice from Greenland and Antarctica. There is strong evidence that global sea level is currently rising at an increased rate. And if you look there in that nice map that was in the report, it's showing relative sea level changes along the coast. And you can see all those up arrows are along our east coast. So not only is sea level rising due to, the glaciers melting and thermal expansion of seawater, but a lot of the land in the Southeast is actually subsiding. And so this is exacerbating sea level rise. What this report says is that at a very minimum, we can expect 2 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century. And that we know with rising seas comes additional impacts such as coastal erosion, inundation, storm surges, saltwater intrusion, and impacts on ecosystems. Additionally, and this is true throughout the Southeast, is that the loss of coastal landforms like barrier islands, we know that they form a storm surge barrier, and without those barriers, the coastal communities are at even increased risk. So what you're looking at here is a sea level rise image of Charleston, South Carolina with 3 feet of sea level rise. And because sea level rise is such a serious and imminent threat, the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy worked with our allies and a group called Architecture 2030 to produce not only this sea level rise image, but you'll see two more, to show just how vulnerable we are here in the Southeast and to show that these things, impacts from global warming can actually and will happen in our own backyard. You'll see that little link there on the bottom left. This is to our sea level rise video, which we also produced in collaboration with many of our partners here with the Southeast Coastal Climate Network. I highly encourage you all to check that out. The next image here shows Savannah, Georgia with 3 meters of sea level rise. And any increase in sea level can have no apparent effect until an elevation is reached that allows saltwater intrusion. So these impacts can happen gradually, and we might not see them until we notice them in things like our freshwater supplies. Here's Fort Lauderdale with 4 feet of sea level rise. And in the bottom left-hand corner, we've also created another video for the Miami area and other parts of Florida. And actually, this video will be translated into Spanish in the next month, so we will have those resources available to those of you who are interested, and we'll post that on the website, and I'll send an alert out to once we have that translated video. So here's a slide on how folks are coping with sea level rise. You'll see on the left here that this is an image of beach renourishment, where beaches pumped from somewhere else onto beaches that are eroding. And adaptation to sea level rise is already taking place throughout the Southeast and in some ways, and they fall generally in 3 main categories. One is hard structures, such as levees and seawalls, although it should be noted that hard structures can, in some cases, actually increase risks and worsen beach erosion and wetland retreat. Two, there are adaptation strategies in place where people are accommodating for rising seas by elevating or redesigning structures, enhancing wetlands and even adding sand from elsewhere. So that's what you see there in the image. And beach renourishment is not a permanent solution. Barrier islands and beaches are eroding as sea level rises. And in fact, this can encourage unwise development in vulnerable locations. And lastly, three, there are some communities that are planning retreat from the coastline as sea level rises. Next slide here shows an image of Hurricane Hugo there on the right in 1989. And the destructive potential of Atlantic hurricanes has increased since 1970. That's what the report discusses. And it's correlated, of course, with an increase in sea surface temperatures. So there's a very strong correlation between sea surface temperatures and hurricane intensity, but there's no correlation with the frequency. So we can expect an intensity of hurricane activity, but not, it is unclear how much more frequent they will become. But we can expect that these hurricanes will come with higher peak wind speeds, rainfall intensity, and storm surge height and strength. So this image here, I think, is pretty powerful. It shows the land loss during the 2005 hurricanes, Rita and Katrina. What these images show are the Chandler Islands. They're just east of New Orleans. And during those two hurricanes, 217 square miles of land and wetlands were lost to open water during these hurricanes. That's nearly 85% of the island's landmass. I'd like to point out here that even with no increase in hurricane intensity, coastal inundation, shoreline retreats, would increase as sea level rise accelerates, and this is actually the most costly consequence of a warming climate for our southeast region. And human health is at risk. Climate change poses unique challenges to human health, including heat waves, severe storms, ailments caused or exacerbated by air pollution and airborne allergens, and many climate-sensitive infectious diseases. Vulnerability is greater for those, of course, who have fewer resources and fewer choices. And whether or not increased health risks due to climate are realized will depend largely on societal responses and underlying vulnerability. And the probability of these health risks becoming exacerbated due to climate points to a need to really maintain a strong public health infrastructure and a public outreach campaign to help limit future impacts. Briefly, I'll talk about the impacts to agriculture. Agriculture and ranching are already under pressure due to an increasingly limited water supply in many parts of our region. And these regions are already stressed by rising temperatures. Heat and drought will impact agricultural yields and could wither crops. And as temperatures begin to increase, the optimal zones for growing particular crops will shift. And the report states that milder winters and earlier springs can also trigger pest infestations. And something that we hear a lot is that people say that CO2 will encourage growth. And in fact, CO2 might increase the productivity of some crops, but it can also lead to an increase of weeds, which may call for an increase usage of pesticides and more work. But there are opportunities associated with these impacts to agriculture, and really successful adaptation to these impacts will require diversification of crops and livestock, as well as transitioning from irrigated to rain-fed agriculture. And so this is important for farmers to be educated on the impacts and options. The producers who can adapt to changing climate conditions are very likely to see their businesses survive, and some might even thrive. Others without resources or this information or ability to adapt effectively will lose out. I think this map is really interesting here. And if you look at the colors, it's showing the population change in percent. So the blue colors show a decrease in population, and the warmer colors, the red and the oranges, show an increase in population. So you can see that many people are flocking to the southeast because it's, frankly, a really nice place to live. And this could result in quality of life to be diminished here in the southeast. It will be affected by increasing heat stress, water scarcity, severe weather events, and reduced availability for insurance for at-risk properties. So again, looking at this graph, the growth of population in the United States over the last 100 years has been most rapid in the south, especially near the coast and in large urban areas. Now, focusing there on Florida, which has the most maroon colors in it, showing a rapid increase in population, over the past 100 years, Florida, the Sun Belt, has attracted people, industry, investments, and the population of Florida has more than doubled during the past 30 years, and growth rates in most other southeastern states are in the range of 45 to 75%. What's interesting is that, you know, any future population growth will have an impact on the quality of life here, such as reduced insurance availability, increased insurance costs, an increase in water scarcity, sea level rise, and other things that I've talked about. And this is a good opportunity to point out that insurance is one of the industries particularly vulnerable to climate change, but it also can help society manage the risks. And so SACE and partners are beginning to do a little bit more work with insurance companies and their risk mitigation and adaptation strategies. Let's briefly talk about the impacts on energy supply and usage. When temperatures rise, we will see a demand for cooling energy. This will increase this will cause increases in electricity use and higher energy demand during peak hours. Energy production will be constrained by this rising temperature and limited water supplies in some areas of our southeast. Energy production and delivery systems that are exposed to sea level rise are extremely vulnerable. There is a case study here in this report that really points out how vulnerable Florida's energy infrastructure is to sea level rise and storm impacts. They say that most of the petroleum products consumed in Florida are delivered by a barge to two or three ports on the eastern side of the state and one on the western side, and that the interdependencies of natural gas distribution, transportation, fuel distribution, and delivery are all very much connected. And that was the impacts were really evidenced by recent recovery from hurricanes in Florida in the last couple of years. So one of the options here is to diversify our energy resources. And I'd like to point out that the Southeast gets most of its energy from coal and nuclear. In fact, over 60% of our power in the Southeast comes from coal-fired power plants. So in essence, you know, building more coal-fired plants and using more coal resources could end up creating a worse problem for us here in the Southeast. What you see here are a few images of potential opportunities for the South. Actually, on the right picture of the solar panels is showing, that's actually SACE's executive director's house, Steve Smith. He got solar panels recently installed on his house. We have a lot of potential here in the South. In fact, SACE did a report. They published a report in February, and it was entitled Yes, We Can, Southern Solutions for a National Renewable Energy Standard. And I highly encourage those of you who haven't seen it to check it out. And it really makes a great point that we do have the resources here in the Southeast to diversify our energy profile. So what we do today will ultimately depend on future climate impacts. And all of these forces that I talked about today converge and interact at the coasts, making our area here in the Southeast, particularly on the coast, sensitive to the impacts of climate change. So the choices we make today about emissions now and in the coming years will have far-reaching consequences. A consistent finding of this assessment is that the rate and the magnitude of future climate change and resulting impacts depend critically on the level of global atmospheric heat-trapping gas concentrations, and that lowering these emissions is essential, and that any delay will only magnify the impacts in the future. We must we must change how we use, produce, and consume, how we produce and consume energy in this country, and we must be prepared to adapt to the unavoidable impacts of global warming. So I would like to briefly tell you all on the call about a couple networks that SACE is a host of. One is the Southeast Coastal Climate Network, which is a group of about 52 members from Maryland to Louisiana. We work on coastal climate issues together. We've produced videos together. We have done congressional outreach together. It's a great resource to get plugged in to what the impacts and opportunities are here in the Southeast. If you live in Florida, I highly recommend that you join the Florida Climate Alliance. It essentially has the same mission as the Southeast Coastal Climate Network, but with a Florida focus. And those links to the group sites are there. You do have to be a member. You can see the summary pages, but you click anywhere and it'll ask you to join. It's a great resource for finding reports and webinar opportunities. Lastly, we are working on federal climate and energy policy, and I would like to offer anybody who is interested in finding out about more about what we're doing with the climate and energy bill to contact me. And if you're interested in working on that with us, I can give you some fact sheets and plug you in. And lastly, there is my contact information, tony@cleanenergy.org, and please visit our website under the multimedia tab. If you go to webinars, you'll be able to see the recording and this presentation on the website in the next few days. On there is also a link to our blog, which Ula explained earlier. And lastly on this slide, that is again the link to this full global climate change report. So I'd be happy to take any questions at this time. You can press *6 to unmute yourself. You may also raise your hand virtually if you look at your control box on your GoToWebinar panel. You can see a little hand there, and you can raise it there if you'd like. And please go ahead and state your name and where you're from when you ask a question. Thank you.
Okay, if folks have questions, go ahead and jump right in.
Tony, Dave Kyler, Sustainable Coast.
Hi, Dave.
Hey, good job. On this agricultural transformation that would be needed to deal with periods of drought, do you have any response from or any position that the agricultural industry or community has taken to recognize the need to do that? And it seems to me that there's great possibility that they're going to push for more and more water for irrigation rather than or before they face the reality of having to switch to drought-resistant crop types, you know?
Mm-hmm. I do know that in some cities, as they outlined in this report, that they are using rain barrels and other alternative techniques to get water to the crops. In some parts of the country, they are actually already trying to figure out how regional climate will change in the future and plan their crops accordingly. And some organizations that are working on that are doing a full force effort to educate ranchers and farmers on their options. I think that maybe one of our staffers, John Bonnets, who works with agricultural communities, he may have more information on particular things that farmers are doing in North Carolina. But I do not know of any other steps that other southern states are taking to address the agricultural issue.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me this would be very germane to the agriculture research extension offices in the respective universities.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
And they, well, although they may not be doing a damn thing about it, they should be tuning into that.
I agree.
So I think we ought to do something to follow up with them.
I will look into that, Dave, and I'll see. I'll make a few phone calls to some extension agents and see if they know what sorts of more local steps that they're taking to address the water issue here in the South. And if anybody on this call knows, feel free to chime in just unmute yourself.
Another question would have be related to what can be is being done somewhere else that we could propagate down here to induce local governments to look more realistically at this kind of stuff in relation to land use decisions and ordinance land use decisions.
Right. Well, I know here in Charleston, the mayor has put together a Charleston Green Committee, and they are incorporating climate change impacts into the recommendations that they'll be giving to the mayor. So I think there are some local communities that are putting together climate adaptation plans and mitigation plans. This is the case for other places like in Washington State and Kings County, for example. They do have an adaptation manual that was produced actually a couple years ago. So they've been thinking about this for a while. And I know that I think your group, Dave, and the Georgia Conservancy have been pushing Savannah to get a plan for action.
But nothing at the level of the ordinances yet.
Of the what? I'm sorry?
Of local ordinances. Right now it's just adaptation planning, but not down to the ordinances.
Right. And for the Charleston Green Committee, I think that they may even have already given the mayor their recommendations in the last meeting, and then it'll slowly be implemented into ordinances. I guess it's a slower process. I saw a news story earlier today that North Carolina Coastal Management Commission, something like that, is now requesting feedback from the public as to their perception of sea level rise and what should be done. So I'm guessing they will utilize that information and put into some sort of plan, municipal planning document.
Do we have other questions?
Yeah, Tony, I have a quick one. This is Jamie Decker. I'm with Ecology and Environment. We have an office in Greenville, South Carolina.
Yeah, very good.
And we've been talking a lot. We do a lot of permitting and environmental work in all of the subject matter that you talked about. What we're finding, though, too, is that there is a severe challenge in the South with indigenous renewable resources to help diversify those portfolios. We've heard with ridge laws that onshore, like on land wind, would be difficult. Offshore, there are studies, but it seems that people are weary because of the hurricanes. And I just wondered, they keep going back to the nuclear debate and saying, we don't know how many indigenous renewable resources we have here. Mm-hmm. So hearing that and then hearing your presentation is interesting to me, because I'm wondering if there is a certain renewable or an area that you're concentrating on more than others to help educate, about what other possibilities the South can do.
Right. This is a really good question, and I would like to refer you back to our Yes We Can Southern Solutions for Renewable Energy Standard report that will give you a lot of technical information on how we can actually achieve the diversification of our energy resources. We do have some regional wind working groups right now in Georgia and in South Carolina. There's right now being formed a South Carolina Wind Working Group with a specific interest in making offshore wind in South Carolina reality. And the SACE, in conjunction with the Department of the Department of Energy gave SACE and the South Carolina Energy Department a grant to actually invest some time into getting public acceptance for offshore wind resources. We're also working in North Carolina for coastal winds, and there's a ton of resources, offshore wind resources in North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia. It's really going to come down to public acceptance and political will.
Yeah,
for sure.
I agree.
Mm-hmm. Now, there also is a report done by the Southern Company in Georgia called Southern Winds. That's a technical report showing, how much resource there is off the Georgia coast. So there's lots of potential. Again, I think, because we don't have an offshore wind farm to showcase here in the United States, we just need to get that first one and do it right the first time, for it to be, you know, a shining example of what we can do here.
Excellent.
And we have staff working in North Carolina with farmers to work on biomass energy. So we do have a lot of resources in the South. Thing SACE does really well is connecting with the resources to decision makers.
Great.
So
feel
free to email me after this presentation,
yeah,
and I will have your email address, and I can point you in the right direction in terms of resources and other staff that we have.
All right, fantastic. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Just remember to *6 to unmute yourself.
Hello, this is Roy Taylor from the Atlanta metro area.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
One of the things that I am concerned about that was sort of alluded to earlier was the length of time that it is taking to get through this process,
mm-hmm,
and whether or not you and the Southern Alliance is looking at things that would increase the speed by which we seem to be able to get the information out there, especially as we're developing this science-based,
mm-hmm,
solution.
Do you mean getting the information to decision makers to be incorporated in federal policy?
Well, there is,
make the change actually happen, or
there is that, but here in our area, we seem to be running up against people who don't even believe that any of this stuff exists as an issue. That
right,
that you and I are just freaks, and that we are somehow trying to run around with a sky is falling, and mm-hmm, this is going to attract attention to ourselves, and that this is really not a real problem, and
mm-hmm,
I am discouraged at the moment,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
because of that, and yet I am here online and with you because I'm looking for tools with which to try and make the public understand, because I believe it's just a perception. I think as soon as the public has a sense that this is a real issue, that things will happen fairly quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But how do we get that perception changed without resorting to fear-based tactics?
Absolutely. And that is a great question. And SACE and our allies have done some research on actually how to communicate global warming issues to the public. We've done focus groups in Florida, in Tampa, Florida, and in Charleston, showing them our sea level rise images that I showed you in the PowerPoint presentation, and trying to figure out what messages kind of appeal to people. Without, you know, we don't want to be doom and gloom, but we did. After those focus groups, we had worked with a messaging firm, a communications firm up in D.C., and we've produced a one-pager called Communicating Climate Change, General Rules of the Road, and I'd be happy to share this with anybody on the call who wants to better communicate these issues to people in your family, to people in your churches, et cetera. And this just kind of gives you an idea of how to approach the subject of global warming and how to approach it and how not to approach it. And we've incorporated these lessons into our Charleston Sea Level Rise video. For example, one really important conclusion from our focus group research and other research people have done on this topic is that the messenger is really important. Messengers such as local academics, medical, and science professionals will make that message more credible. And so with our Charleston Sea Level Rise video, you'll notice that our narrator, it has a very distinct South Carolina accent, and he is an NPR celebrity here in South Carolina, and everybody knows his voice. It's very distinctive. So having the right messenger is really important. Using independent and neutral resources, neutral sources will validate information You always want to be positive. Not doom and gloom doesn't work for people because it makes them feel really helpless. You want to start with common sense, balanced solutions that save money, create jobs, you know, those sorts of things are all in our communications one-pager. And again, I'd be happy to share that with folks. Just send me an email and I'll send you some information on that. But yes, I think being able to communicate the science, you know, the impacts as well as the opportunities is crucial into getting public acceptance and action. And I also have some focus group results I can share with you as well. So,
this is Brian Paddock from Tennessee. You also might want to check the Climate Project, which was Al Gore's original project to train people to do his slideshow. And many of those...
Yeah, our director was trained actually by Al Gore to deliver that. That's a good point. I will incorporate any documents there into how to communicate.
Yeah.
There's also a book that I have that's called Communicating Climate Science. I'll include that reference as well. I don't have it near me. I can't remember the title exactly. So there are resources out there.
Right. The Climate Project people have actually been keeping that slideshow up to date with slides, and many of the presenters have worked for several years now to hone those presentations in for specific audiences and specific communities and specific parts of the discussion. So if you sign up online for those presentations, get one for some group that you're, you know, a member of, and after you've seen what the presenter does and get to know them, you may want to help that person find other places where they can go off and do the work of helping people understand.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. Also, one suggestion when you're communicating this with people is that you really want to bring the message to people's backyards. You know, a lot of times when you talk about global warming and global changes, people think it's not going to happen to them. These are things that are outside of their neighborhood. So always have to, you know, drive the message that, no, this is really going to happen to us in our neighborhoods.
This is Brian Paddock again. If I could go back to the one, there was one discussion earlier about land use change and local ordinances, and I would point out that there's called the Model Forest Policy Program, which you can find on, I think it's just mpp.org, you can find on the net, which has marshaled a great deal of resources, which are free if you sign in, from all over the country on local government actions, and some of them actually go down to that ordinance level. Some of them start with creating local task forces and work groups, and then others go clear through to changing your land use plans, your transportation plans, and so on. And it has the Model Forest Program has a particular emphasis on making sure those plans include the protection of forest and forest canopy and water resources.
That's an excellent resource.
Yeah, it works together.
Yeah, I will look that up and email that out to the group as well.
Another along those lines, this is Mary Ann Holtz in St. Pete, Florida. The Post-Carbon Cities and the Transition U.S. Networks, are you familiar with those, Tony? Does SAFE work
not
with them? You might want to check that out too, postcarbon.org. Richard Heinberg and the folks who are saying, look, we need to keep the two crises in mind at the same time, climate and peak oil, because for a lot of people who don't believe climate is going to affect them, you know, who are into just their own little immediate life, peak oil is going to, you know, it's going to affect all, and it's going to affect everything we do about climate. So the kind of planning they're doing, and they're working with a number of municipalities around the country and counties, is saying we need to plan for both at the same time and make all of our decisions based on keeping both of those crises in mind. Good stuff. So postcarbon.org.
Postcarbon.org. That's excellent. Thank you.
And
yeah.
This is Roy Taylor. Again, I want to reinforce the Transitions Initiative or Transitions Town information you were just being brought up there. I am currently in this area working. We've got the Cherokee North Metro Atlanta.
Okay.
And we have the Cherokee Transitions Green, which is a very early starting program of the Transitions Initiative for this area. So I just wanted to reinforce what was being said.
And that was Transitions Town?
Transition Towns or Transition Initiatives.
Okay.
Google either of those and you'll find lots of information about
it. It's actually right on that postcarbon.org website. You'll see
it.
Oh,
excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Does anybody have any other questions?
Yes, this is Adrian Brunori. I'm in the Tampa, Florida area. And I wanted to address the issue about messaging, the difficulty of getting the message across.
Mm-hmm.
There are ways to approach climate change by, you know, getting outside of the box. One of them is a climate project initiative that addresses faith-based groups and approaches the situation that way. It's stewardship of the earth without directly dealing with whether or not climate change is going on or not is a good way to do it, your message. And another thing that I've experienced here in lobbying for solar policy, getting outside the box, we had James Woolsey, director of the CIA, advocate for renewable energies in Florida based solely on his national security concerns. So that's another way to approach the issue outside the box. And lastly, there needs to be some more focus on policy surrounding the ability to implement renewables. It's very hard to finance these projects because the policies are so complicated. In Florida, we've had huge success in Gainesville, is the first municipality to adopt the feed-in tariff policy, which is predominant worldwide. It's very simple. The utility gives a 20-year contract to purchase the power, and the bank will finance based on that contract. There's no tax dollars used, no rebates, and it's a very successful global policy. So there are...
I'm sorry, I think you got cut off there. Any other questions? I think we lost our speaker, whoever was asking that question. Are there any other questions?
Yeah, Tony, this is Vicki from the Alliance for Climate Protection, Vicki Weeks. And one of the things, it seems to me we in selling this in terms of building public support, the line is to make people aware of the urgency while at the same time giving them hope that action now makes a difference.
Right.
And I'm just wondering if there's any kind – and the issue is all this is like in 2050 and 2080 and 2100. And so there's sort of this lack of immediacy, you know. I mean,
right.
We know that this isn't going to happen all of a sudden on December 31st, 2099, the
sea
level rises, you know, 3 meters. But is there any kind of resource that we can access that shows dynamic change over time and how that dynamic changes given impact of action now?
That is a really good question. This particular report just mentions numerous times that we must take action now or the impacts will be greater, but nowhere in this particular report does it really show the kind of detail you were just discussing. I will definitely
look
into that, but I do understand what you're saying, and that is a problem when we communicate it, is that people think, oh, well, I'm not going to be around by then, so why should I do something now? But the fact is we all know that these changes are gradual. And, in fact, the climate record shows that climate can change very abruptly. We see that from the paleoclimate record. Changes can happen, you know, in less than 50 years.
Yeah, and if we can show people
a better way to articulate that.
If we can show people how their action now actually is going to impact the outcome, I think it gives them more motivation to get involved in a proactive way.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Now, I know that there are estimates that, you know, like in the IPCC volume and even in this report, they show different emission scenarios, you know, based on different, you know, business as usual. And if we take action, you know, different sorts of policies and how that will impact the CO2 concentrations by the end of the century. That's the only thing I can think of that graphically shows that if we take action now, we will, in fact, lower the amount of emissions over time.
So in this full report, we might be able to extrapolate that kind of data?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if it'll be in the same sort of detail that you're looking for. I don't think they really went into exactly
like
what impacts
in
we would
2015, avoid. 2025, 2040,
no.
2000, you know.
Yeah, I understand that is a need for sure. It's not in this report.
Okay.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Actually,
any other questions?
Just on that note, this is Marianne again. The ABC News special, Earth 2100, that was on air a month or so ago, did an amazingly good job of doing that kind of thing by using what they called a graphic novel, interspersed with a lot of great interviews with folks from Harvard University and all kind of folks, talking both about climate change and peak oil and the economic collapse and all that kind of stuff. So in terms of timelines, while they're saying, yes, we're doing this as a graphic novel, there were some pretty powerful kinds of things about if we don't make changes by 2015, here's how it might look, by 2025, by, you know. So you might want to look into that. It's available through ABC News.
Great. I will do that.
DVD.
I do believe that SACE did do a blog on that in late June. I'll have to look back
at
that. I do know we blogged about it. Very good. Any other questions? We are at about 1 o'clock here, and I see that people have typed in a few questions. We a couple people asked the same question, how can you get a copy of this PowerPoint? It will be available on our website. That's cleanenergy.org. If you go to our multimedia tab, then webinars, you will see not only this webinar, which will be posted by the end, but also webinars that we've done in the last year. And there's some audio as well as PowerPoint. So you're welcome to use these slides. And other than that, I think I've answered the questions. Gwen here has a question about what if the role is, the role and status of carbon offset market as incentives for mitigation and adaptation in the Southeast. And unfortunately, I don't know a whole lot about the carbon offset market and the incentives for mitigation and adaptation. I'm not sure if there's another staff person on the call that could answer that, but I will look into that for you, Gwen, and send you an answer.
Yeah, Tony, I think Jen may be able to answer that question.
Okay. I think she might be getting off to get another call. Let me see if I can catch her real quick.
Yeah, not necessarily right now, but Gwen, if you wanted to follow up with Jen Rennick in our office, we could ask that question.
Yes, I'll make sure to get that info to you.
Yeah, so we're also at time, and that's kind of a long answer.
Very good. Well, thanks, everybody, for joining us today. And if you have any questions, please email me at toni@cleanenergy.org. I also want to encourage you all to join the Southeast Coastal Climate Network or the Florida Climate Alliance if you live in Florida. And those links are on as part of this PowerPoint. So thank you all, and I look forward to hearing from you in the future.
Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.